Hello, Cassie McCullough with you for Best of the Festivals. I hope you're having a relaxing Boxing Day. All this week, we've been bringing you some of our favourite interviews of the year with prize-winning authors who spoke at writers' festivals around Australia and further beyond. Today, American author A.M. Holmes. She won the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction in 2013 for her novel May We Be Forgiven. The Bailey's Prize was formerly known as the Orange Prize. It's a dark satire of domestic life in 21st century America, tracking Harry Silver, a scholar whose brother is sent to a psychiatric facility after killing a couple in a terrible car accident. Harry finds himself parenting his brother's children while at the same time looking after his aging parents, losing his job, getting divorced, and venturing into the world of internet dating. Suffice to say, it's a lot to juggle. Let's cross now to the stage at this year's Sydney Writers' Festival to hear A.M. Holmes in conversation with Susan Windham, the literary editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. But before we get to the book, an obvious question. What does the A.M. stand for?
Well, the joke is it's almost maybe, but it's not. It's Amy Michael Holmes, which was a family thing, but I'm not an Amy. Amy's are, we're talking about this. They're nice, they're pleasant.
They're little women.
Right, they're little women. So not me. And I used to just put my name on my, well, A.M. on my homework, also because I'm very dyslexic, and that was probably the best I could do. And then it just, they would say A.M., and I would go, yes. So it's just, it really is A.M. Everyone keeps thinking it's Amy, but it's just A.M.
Mm. And you published your first book at 19.
Yes.
As A.M. Holmes. Yeah. What was driving you to write at that early age? You were writing even when you were at school.
I had to get out of the house. I stayed home from 10th grade, which so that's about when you're about 15. I went to a math class. I was just in school, and the teacher said, I don't like your attitude. And I thought, I didn't know I had one, and I thought, I'm never coming back here again. Because I really was honestly just sitting there. And I was also very, very shy, which most people would know. In 8th grade, I wore my winter coat all year. And it was one of those ones that was sort of a polar bear explorer coat with the fur around the collar, and I wore it with the hood up all during school all day because I thought it would seem less noticeable. And also that honestly, and it goes back to the memory, it would actually make my butt look smaller if I had this giant coat on.
Right.
Who knew?
Okay.
You know,
like, but hang on, what's that got to do with writing?
I don't know. So I stayed home and I wrote a book of poems called An Introduction to Death with Excerpts from Life, and it was all these very like adolescent depressing poems that I made my mother type. And she would call the therapist in between typing.
Right, right.
The joke is, the running joke is I was the worst child ever. And I think it's true. And my mother would be getting these horrible screaming fights. And she would say, one day I hope when you grow up you have a little girl just like you. And I go, I hope I do. And then, of course, I have this little girl who's just like me. And I called my mother up and I said, Mom, help. Like, she's just like me. And she goes, oh, no, she couldn't possibly be as bad.
But the creative impulse still, I mean, what was happening? Were you drawing on your life, or did you have dark thoughts as a teenager?
Yeah, well,
that would be unique.
Yeah, that would be unique. No, I had them before I was a teenager, actually. I started smoking when I was 8. I had smoked full-time from the time I was 8 till I was 18. I was just really, I'm adopted, and I think the idea, honestly, of being given up and given away before they even know who you are, I found it profoundly insulting. And until I met my biological family, and I thought, fine, I get it. It's better this way, and let's just leave it at that. But I would, and I literally, when I would be very upset about things, I would cry, and I'd go, I want my mom, I want my real mom, which now as a parent, I see how painful for my mother that was, you know. Mm. She'd be like, I am your mother. I'm like, no, you're not really my mother. Then as soon as I met the biological mother, I never had that thought again. Mm. I'm like, mom. You know, I call my mom still twice a day, even on this trip. And every time I call her, this is the weirdest thing, she laughs. I go, it's true. She's so happy to hear from me. She's 87, and I try to check in on her in the morning and at night. And we're incredibly close, but it's hard won for both of us, I think.
Was she shocked that she produced a writer?
No, there's other writers. It's funny, so here I am adopted, but there's other writers in the family. There's a guy named Scott Spencer who wrote the book Endless Love and a bunch of other things. Mm. And my grandmother, who was a huge influence on me, wanted to write and wrote a little bit, and she grew up in Massachusetts, and the family is Jewish, and when she went to college at 16, and they said to her, we don't really know why you're going to college to be a teacher, because no one will ever hire you because you're Jewish. And she sort of said, well, I'm going anyway. She also has this incredible story of she didn't know that she needed glasses till she was about 16, and she looked up and she'd never seen stars before, which to me is just like the most heartbreaking whatever. So she was this incredible woman who ultimately brought her whole family, meaning all the brothers and sisters, to Washington, D.C., and they all got jobs. And she helped start the first bank in the United States. It was a bank started by women for women. And the idea was that a lot of women couldn't get credit. You could only get credit under your husband's name. But if they were divorced or had never married, they could never get credit. Mm-hmm. So it was a big shift in things. She was a real kind of... And she loaned me money to buy a typewriter because I didn't have a typewriter. Everyone else in my family, for some reason, had one, but I didn't. And she loaned me money, and I bought an IBM Selectric, which was that, you know, the big massive one, and I had to pay her back $50 a month. And when I finally paid her back all the money, she gave me all the money back and said, I wanted you to learn that, you know, as well.
It's fantastic.
She was great.
Beautiful. Obviously a huge inspiration.
Yes, absolutely.
In many ways, yeah. It's obvious that your writing has grown out of life, as it tends to do. Yeah. But you love to write about ordinary urban or suburban lives, families sort of gone amok, you know, because of an accident or illness or, you know, some violent act or dark obsessions and other impulses.
Yeah.
And, I mean, just to give a few examples, there's the friendship between a pedophile and a young woman in probably A.M.'s most controversial novel, The End of Alice. There's a psychiatrist emotionally involved with her patient in A Country of Mothers. There's the bored couple who blow up their lives deliberately in Music for Torture. There's characters like the girl in one of your short stories who picks up used condoms from the beach and inseminates herself. You know, it's the sort of normal life, really. I mean, they're extreme but still possible scenarios.
Right. Right.
And I'm wondering, do you have a kind of catastrophic imagination that imagines a situation and then thinks, how bad could it possibly be?
You know, it's funny that you say that. I mean, on the one hand, I think I write what's been described sometimes as emotional science fiction, which is pushing at the edges, at the emotional edges of things and how far they go, and the difference always between our public and private selves. But when you're asking, do I have a catastrophic imagination? I'm the kid who, when I was little, and in the public library, there would be these, like, I guess it was still during when we used to have, like, atomic bomb testing, and they would see, you know, these warnings or whatever. I would always pick up the disaster preparedness guides. And even today, as we were walking on the beach and somebody got something in there, I got like, I have it. I've got artificial tears here. I have every possible thing with me that you might need. I have an EpiPen. I have syringes. Anyone needs surgery right now, just give me a call. I'll fix it for you. There's nothing. I mean, I like being ready. So I think on the one hand, I'm very ready, but I must think catastrophically in some way.
Do bad things happen to you?
Bad things do not happen to me. I would not tolerate that.
That's good. Okay. So people often call your work satire, which is probably fair. They call it dark comedy. Do you agree with either of those labels?
I don't think about it in those ways. You know, I really honestly think about it in terms of characters and what's organic to a character and telling stories. And I think for me the most important thing is writing fiction or telling stories, if it's in nonfiction, that provoke people to think and to look at who they are, who we are as people, how we relate to each other, our expectations of each other and ourselves. So it's not about having answers, but it is about provoking thought, whether it's a really very dark, very difficult story about a jailed pedophile murderer or, you know, a story about my being adopted. The criteria sort of stays the same.
On Books and Arts Daily here on RN, I'm Michael Cathcart, and a special program today recorded at the 2014 Sydney Writers' Festival, a conversation between the American author A.M. Holmes and Sydney Morning Herald literary editor Susan Windham.
Well, let's look at the latest novel, May We Be Forgiven, which came out in 2012 and has won the Women's Prize for Fiction in Britain. For those who haven't read it, just very briefly, the story starts with two brothers, Harry and George. Harry is kissed by his brother George's wife over Thanksgiving dinner in the kitchen. George then goes out and has some kind of breakdown, drives his car into a family and kills most of them. And while Harry is comforting George's wife, while Harry is in the psychiatric ward. They end up sleeping together. George leaves the hospital, comes home, finds them in bed together, and bludgeons his wife over the head.
And that's by page 30, by
that's
the way.
That's page 14. That's why I'm telling you. I'm not giving,
exactly.
anything,
You're not giving
away.
Anything away. It's just the opening paragraph.
That's exactly. Which is quite full on and, keeps you reading. Now, you thank, in your acknowledgement, you thank Zadie Smith for asking the question that got this whole thing going.
Yeah.
What did she ask?
She asked me to write a short story about that was character driven, about a strong character. And I started writing. I'd been thinking about brothers and sort of the intensity of the relationship that can be very competitive, kind of a Cain and Abel of one good and one bad. And I started writing and I just couldn't stop, and I couldn't actually finish in time for that short story. And then Granta called when they were doing their 100th issue and said, like, can we have something? And we sort of snipped off a piece, which is that beginning part, but it just kept going, and it was interesting because it turned into a novel that's very, very long, but that was written with the compression of a short story, which for me was sort of fun and also really sort of an acrobatic feat of how do you do that for 700 pages or something.
What do you mean by compression when you are talking about such a long novel?
Right. I mean, I think it reads very quickly, and it really, you know, I always describe the differences that a novel is like taking a train across a country. You get it on one end of the country, and it wanders across the country. And a short story is already in motion when you get on it. And this has that sense of being really a roller coaster ride and a lot of motion in it. There are no chapters. When I turned it in, the editor called me and goes, chapters? Huh? Too late. We put in space breaks in case someone had to go to the bathroom. But it's really meant to be, you know, consumed rapidly.
Yeah,
which is,
and
it's tightened in those ways.
Mm. I actually wondered if the writing that you do for television, you've adapted your own works, you've written for the L Word, you've just adapted The Fall, the British series for American television. I wondered if that had started to influence your fiction writing. It's those short scenes, a lot of dialogue.
I think for me the dialogue, you know, I grew up on theater and plays, and it's really the work of Harold Pinter and Edward Albee and even people like Carol Churchill in terms of the I would say the surrealist or the kind of more difficult subject matter and language play. So that's where that comes from for me. Mm. You know, television writing is so specific to form, and they're really... Every show and every network has its own formats of the number of acts, and these things act in and act out, which are really like the way you would shape a chapter. They have to have specific beginnings and endings. But I don't think it's influenced the way I write. I would say whenever I get to go back to writing fiction, I'm hugely relieved because, number one, when you're writing a novel, there's never a phone call you get where 14 people say, hi, we're here from the studio, the network, and the producers, and your agent is off and on. You know, it's like... You're just sitting there as the writer going like, it's terrifying.
The morality of this novel is really interesting.
Yeah.
Because obviously George is the brother who mows down a family and who hits his wife over the head with a lamp and is angry and causes a lot of problems to everyone else around him. But his brother Harry is the one who's had an affair with his sister-in-law and set off, you could say, some of the events.
Right.
And poor old Harry is the one who dreadful things keep happening to through this novel. Were you trying to give us a moral dilemma here? You know, is there a right and a wrong?
That's a hard question to answer. I think moral dilemmas interest me a lot.
Mm.
I think answering a question of right and wrong is not something I can do. Do you know what I mean? In the sense that I want to explore, like also in this book, but in The End of Alice with the pedophile, I mean, I have obviously very strong feelings about that, but I think part of it for me is posing the questions and taking the reader on the journey, and then the reader makes their own decisions about where the moral compass and lines are. But that said, morality interests me a lot. I mean,
So what were the questions you wanted to ask in this novel?
In this novel, it was a lot for me about family and brothers. And also, you know, Harry Silver talks about sort of waiting for his life to start, and he's already in the middle of his life, and I describe it sometimes as a midlife coming-of-age story. And I think for him the question was, can Harold Silver grow up? Can he become an adult? Can he become someone who's capable of parenting what are now his brother's children who he's sort of inherited? Can he become a person? And that, I think, is an interesting problem in question. And I think we all know and see a lot of people who are adults by age, but not necessarily by behavior or countenance.
Mm. Do you enjoy putting pressure on your characters? Is it fun to kind of torture them and see how far you can push it?
No. No, I think what was interesting with this book, too, was when I started writing it, I felt a kind of resistance from the characters, and I kept thinking, why is this character, Harold Silver, so hard to write? In a way, George, the brother, who's kind of more sort of overtly crazy, is easier because he's just, you know, a nut job, kind of, and he's one of those people who I describe him as a man who's closet has the collection of suits in a variety of sizes because he's sometimes very fat and he's sometimes very thin and he self-medicates and he's very out of control. And in fact, I did a lot of research on something called intermittent explosive disorder, which is an anger problem. It seemed to me like a bowel issue, but turns out it's just a mood thing. But so I was trying, because I was trying to understand those people who are explosively angry almost without warning. But Harry was a much more subtle sort of situation. And I think the hard part and the interesting part for me was I was writing about a person who didn't know himself. And only as Harry comes to know himself more did the story really unfold for me and the character really unfold for me. And then the question became, and this is sort of on a literary level as well, it's very easy to write things that kind of roll downhill. And Harry could just, you know, bottom out and crash. And actually the thing that you showed me earlier that you want me to read in a minute, which nobody knows about, is at a low point. But I kept thinking, what has to change for this guy in order for him to sort of turn a corner? Mm. Because I'm interested in, can people change? Can people come out of something in a way? And I think that's another sort of philosophical, moral, social question. And I think on a literary level, people kept saying, oh, she's gone soft. It's a little happy here at the end, or there's hope. And I thought, it's so much harder to get to the hope part than to just kill yourself. I mean, you know, it's amazing in writing how, and it may just be the nature of being a writer and a world of literary critics who are also unhappy very often, but it can just roll downhill so hard and fast, but to turn the corner and come back up is really hard.
Mm. Well, there's a well-known definition of a novel or of plot, I suppose, which is things get worse.
Right.
And you do that very well, and I and I am going to ask A.M. to read a passage, because she does this brilliant thing, which is make things get worse, make poor old Harry suffer, and other characters. Things are not easy for a lot of them. But I found myself reading some of the worst passages and laughing out loud. She's a very funny writer at times, and I actually want to ask you about the craft of creating these effects, this double effect where you're feeling pain and you don't want it to go on and yet you're laughing. And I considered several scenes. There's one where Harry's trying to buy petrol with a credit card that his ex-wife has cancelled and everyone's shouting at him to get out of the way. There's one where Harry's on the phone talking to his brother's psychiatrist while also Googling women he can go out and meet for sex. But the one I chose is this one, A.M.
Look at me. Look what has happened. Look what I have done. Take notice. At the moment, I'm not even talking to you. I'm talking to myself. Look at me, homeless in a public park. I curl into a ball, a human ball in the far corner of the park. I can't look at myself. There's nothing to see. I'm sobbing, wailing, crying so deep, so hard. It is the cry of a lifetime. I'm bellowing. The dog comes to me, licks my face, my ears, tries to get me to stop, but I can't stop. I've just begun. It is as though I will cry like this for years. Look what I have done. And damn it, I'm not even an alcoholic. I'm nothing. Just a guy, a truly average guy, which is probably the worst part of it all, knowing that I'm not in any way exceptional or distinguished. Except for, and until what happened with Jane, I was entirely regular, normal. Since my wedding, I hadn't slept with anyone except my wife. Look at me. Even though no one's come out and said it, you know it as well as I do. I'm as much a murderer as my brother, no more, no less. I say it to myself, and I am undone. A young cop shows up. You okay? I nod. We got a call about a crying man. Is that illegal? No, but you don't see much of that around here, especially this time of year. Home from work? Laid off, and the exterminator's in the house today, and they asked me to leave. Parked seemed like the place to go. Most people go shopping, the cop says. Really? Yeah, when people don't know what to do with themselves, they go to the mall, walk up and down, and spend money. I never thought of it, I say. I'm not much of a shopper. It's what they do. Even with the dog? Yep, you got your outdoor malls and your indoor. The cop stands there. I don't mean to be rude, but this is a public park and I'm minding my own business. No camping, the cop says. No loitering. How can you tell if someone is loitering versus just enjoying a park? The sign says it's open from 7 a.m. to dusk. I walked here with the dog so we could enjoy being outside, but apparently that's not okay. Apparently in this town, going to the park is considered weird. And you know what? You're right. It must be, because there's no one here. The whole park is empty except for you and me, so I apologize.
Thank you. Lovely.
Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and today we're enjoying a real treat. A.M. Holmes in conversation with Susan Windham, recorded at this year's Sydney Writers Festival.
So how do you write a scene like that? Do you...
I've been to that park. No,
is that okay? Did you cry?
No, but I have... No.
It's a matter of putting two things together, I think, isn't it, often?
You know, I don't think about it that way. I mean, I really think it truly, I mean, I had this wonderful writing teacher, a writer named Grace Paley, who was a short story writer. And Grace used to talk about writing the truth according to the character. So first off, when you're, I really am a fiction writer, and I know a lot of people write fiction that is based on their own experiences. For me, and they always say in writing classes, write what you know, and I think, what could be worse? I want to write what I don't want. No, I want to explore what it means to be another person. And I think that the use of humor and the juxtaposition or also just the absurdity of everyday life, if you can make people laugh, I also think you can go in deeper. And that's the thing, because some of this stuff would be just intolerably painful if there weren't for the laugh.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So do you kind of write the difficult stuff and then say, I'll put a joke in here?
No, it just comes. It's
it
all
comes.
Of a piece.
Which it
is,
comes.
You know, knock on whatever. And the funny thing is with this book, too, so... Publishing was at a particularly low moment when I started writing this book. And I just sort of thought, I'm going to take the risk this time, and I'm going to entertain myself, and I'm going to write the book I want with some digressions in it and just allow it to be organically what feels true to this story and to this moment. And I had never really done that before. I'd always been a little bit more careful, despite what it might seem like when you read some of the other ones.
Well, that's interesting. So you mean in the past you've written with a kind of purpose? This will...
No, I think I let myself, my mother said, you let yourself be more funny this time.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I just sort of thought, you know, and there's also little funny, like the Don DeLillo, the writer, who I very much admire, sort of wanders through this book. And in part it's because he lives in reality where this book is set in my imagination. So that was a thing. And then there's weird things like the financial advisor is named Hiram P. Moody, and that's Rick Moody's real name. So there's a lot of people who are threaded through it just for fun, which was, I don't know, one of those, you know.
That is fun.
Yeah, it was.
It's great. As that scene showed you, it's sometimes the petty officials and the sort of the bureaucrats and the people demanding their rights and complaining that cause more pain to the characters than even the huge tragedies in their life. Is that what our society or your society has become? These little niggling,
you know, everything is
things.
Just a negotiation. And I always just think, my favorite is whenever I go to France, and I love the way they are in French, because everything just begins with, it's not possible. You say, can we do this? They go, it's not possible. and I feel like so much of modern life has become that. Just, you know, you go to the bank, and they go, it's not possible. I'd like to mail a letter. Not possible. You know, there's just so many things that we have to do, which I think maybe is why we do so many things online, where it seems like anything is possible.
Yeah.
You can buy a tank online because it's possible.
Okay. You're a very American novelist. Do you think you could be writing anywhere but New York? Could you live in Sydney and write these books? Or is New York what feeds you?
I sometimes don't even go outside. I forget that I'm in New York. I think I am a very American writer, and I think that that's sort of for better and worse, and part of why the books... The good news is I think that the emotional resonance of the books is global and has to do with people. And here, there's some very... To me, what was a lot of fun writing was there's a scene where this boy, Nate, decides he wants to have his bar mitzvah in South Africa because that's what children do. So I did enormous amounts of research about kosher caterers in Durban and how would they get there and what prizes would they give out at the bar mitzvah in South Africa. And also, interestingly, when he wants to give his bar mitzvah money back to the village, His hope is that they'll do something like dig a well or whatever, but what they want is a large TV. And I think that is a reality, that we expect places to stay a certain way or whatever, and we all want to participate in the world for better and worse also. So all that to say, I think if I was living in Sydney and writing in Sydney, that my fiction would change. I would hope it would change a little bit and become more reflective of the people and the personalities and the issues. But I also think that the core things that are about what it is to be a person are universal.
You probably hate this sort of question, but you're sort of in a group that might include Jonathan Franz and Gary Steingart, who you might have seen here.
Gary Jonathan Steingart. They're all named
Gary
Jonathan,
Jonathan Steingart.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's the kind of the absurdity of contemporary life in America, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that fair to group you like that?
I think that they're just, life is absurd, and I think it would be weird to write novels that didn't in some way reflect that. And this one also was the first time. There's a lot of internet in this book, and a lot of online dating, which I did extensive research for.
Good.
And shopping. And the thing, I normally wouldn't do that. I'm always very conscious of you trying to write things that are not sort of as time-stamped in a way. But I also felt that we were living in a time where technology has truly changed the way that we relate and the way that we do these things. And I wanted to sort of illustrate the dissonance within ourselves about how that plays out.
Mm. What is the significance of Richard Nixon in this? Harry is a historian, and he is a Richard Nixon scholar trying to write a book about this man. It seems a rather cynical hero to have.
You know, I think it starts with the fact that I'm increasingly interested in writing about the juxtaposition and the weave of history and fiction. And I look at books, whether it's Don DeLillo's books, Peter Carey's books, that the way that when you play off history in some way, it also allows the fiction to kind of elaborate on things. But I think Nixon, number one, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and Nixon was the sort of first president of my conscious childhood, and it was before there was security and things at the White House, so they were always taking you there for events, and, you know, George Pompidou and Richard Nixon would be, "We welcome you to America, merci," whatever, and we're, like, doing cartwheels on the White House lawn. And Watergate played out as I was a teenager, so my own, talking about morality, my own sort of moral development, I think, was happening right at the same time, and it was broadcast live.
Great role model.
Yes, great role model. Well, you know, I think Nixon was a role model for many presidents afterward when he said, if the president does it, it's not illegal. That resonated around the world. It was inspired leaders everywhere. And I also think, interestingly, you know, Nixon, and the other thing is he is an incredibly unlikely president, so, because he's this bitter man who had very few friends, not charismatic. And the whole thing, even with the Nixon-Kennedy debate, which was the first televised debate, literally still resonates in the sense that when we had our debates, the Romney and Obama debates and things, you might have heard weird things like the temperature in the room was 64 degrees. That's because the temperature was higher and Nixon was sweating, and they felt like people who saw the debate on TV thought Nixon lost, and people who heard it thought he won when they heard it on the radio. So it's all in there, and I guess that fascinates me. And, you know, now China, which Nixon opened U.S. relations to China, China owns more U.S. debt than any other country. Everything is made in China. I mean, the resonance goes all through. And then, interestingly, you know, Nixon also couldn't sleep, and he wrote on these yellow legal pads. So I decided that was Nixon's fiction, the novels and short stories of Richard M. Nixon. And so they're in the book as well. And there was a horrible moment where I'm writing the novels and short stories of Richard M. Nixon. I thought to myself, please stop. I don't really want, I like talking to myself, I don't really want you to write a whole collection of Richard Nixon short stories. But they were based on things in Nixon's life. So I had a lot of fun. And then I went to the Nixon Library, and there's all this sort of, I don't want to call them the secret files, but they were the special files, they were called. You can request them. And it's incredible, just ephemera and correspondence and a lot of great things where it says, you know, note to so-and-so, someone's got to call Ron Reagan more often. His nose is out of joint. And there's like a note, call once a month. And then there was another one, Rosemary Woods, you know, Nixon's famous secretary, who's very good on the gas pedal for erasing things. She there's a note like, you know, dear Mr. President, I notice on your schedule you're free tonight. Fiddler on the Roof is at the National Theater. I thought you'd like to take Mrs. Nixon and Julie. And he writes back, I hate theater. You know, never ask me again. You know, and I just, the stuff that you would never normally see. And then, of course, me being me, I had to go to the gift shop. And I bought this incredible Yorba Linda, California snow globe. And I'm just like, I'm in love with it. And I realized, it doesn't snow in Yorba Linda, but I've got this Richard Nixon birthplace snow globe with snow. And that kind of, that's to me is exactly where we are right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart, and today a special conversation recorded at the Sydney Writers' Festival. A conversation between the American author A.M. Holmes and Sydney Morning Herald literary editor Susan Windham.
Even though you don't write autobiographical fiction, I think you have been kind of drawing on your, as all writers do, drawing on your experience in various ways. And I guess the central experience of your life, as you said, is being adopted and finding your birth, or your birth parents finding you.
Yeah.
And I wondered why you decided in the end to write it as a memoir. A.M.'s beautiful memoir, beautiful and distressing and mad memoir, The Mistress's Daughter, which came out in 2007, tells this story. Why did you decide finally to write
it? Well, it wasn't a finally. I mean,
Suddenly.
The whole thing was such a weird experience. So I grew up, I'm obviously, as you know, and I'm up for adoption again, by the way, if anyone's interested. I come with some dogs, fish, goldfish, children. I have a whole setup, and I can just come right to wherever you are. And you can take care of us. It's good. But anyway, we'll talk about that later. I was adopted into a household where a child had died, and a child who had lived to be 9 years old. And it was literally, I think it was like as though there had been as a baby, it's like, you have a job, you have a mission, you must fix this family. I'm like, wah. It was very, very hard. And it was like growing up, and I only realized this later, it was like growing up in a Eugene O'Neill play. There was just a dark cloud that was only over our house. And so I think it was incredibly formative. And what happened was my biological parents literally reappeared out of the blue when I was in my 30s. And the good news is I'm glad it happened when I was older and kind of already a grown-up, because it would have been very, very difficult to handle. It's as though you sort of think you know who you are, even though you know you're adopted. You've constructed an identity for yourself. And then it's like someone comes in and says, you're not who you thought you were. And by the way, we don't really know who you are anyway. But it was just such a yank of the rug out from under that it was very, very difficult. And I started writing the memoir as an effort to just kind of document the experience of it and find language for it. And I guess part of what prompted me, and I remember as I was writing, I kept saying, you don't have to publish this thing, you can just write it. But because I'd already written several books, I felt like whatever skills I had as a writer helped find language for a kind of very primitive emotional experience that I thought would have meaning for others. And that very much proved itself to be true. And people say, was it cathartic to write? And I think it's like operating on yourself cathartic. Sometimes you just have to do it, but you're not like, oh, I love this. Look, it's bleeding a lot today. So it was very, very hard. And it wasn't, you know, in fiction, there is the fun of finding new information, of telling the story. And I found in nonfiction, and I was very aware of the importance of staying not just true to the story, but actually getting the facts straight, unlike like James Fry, who, you know, had root canals that he never knew he had. And so that was really a mission. I found that very, very hard work, because it's not even the same as journalism where you're telling someone else's story. I was telling my story, and interestingly, I was telling the story of people I never knew, my biological parents. So it was, you know, an unusual thing.
It was a gift, though, to a writer, wasn't it? Because A.M. had idealized these parents she never knew, and when they actually turned up, they were nightmares.
Well,
sorry, but
yeah,
you certainly
were,
make them
they
seem
were,
so.
I know. I think they were. Yeah.
Interesting characters.
Characters, and I think the piece of it is it's amazing how you can. I mean, I also went through a phase where I thought for sure that Susan Sontag and Jack Kerouac had like a one night thing, and I was, you know, the product of that. That was very, and I enjoyed that very much. It seemed like a very, you know, promising thing, and then to find out what really my parents were was difficult. And my mother, my biological mother, was a person who had probably suffered some abuse in her childhood. Her father had been the bookie at the White House and was killed in a shootout with another bookie. She thought he had a heart attack. So just finding the truth in the lies and all these things. And my father was still married and is still married to the woman he'd been married to already. So I have a half-brother who is, you know, 4 months older than me. It's a lot.
Do you see your father anymore?
No, I haven't seen him. I haven't seen him since, I want to say since the first time I saw him, maybe. Mm. No, I haven't seen him since, you know, at least, what, 10 or 15 years. Mm. Yeah.
And all that time has passed now.
Yeah.
And you've written the book and sort of processed all this in some way. What's it done for your sense of yourself?
That's a good question. I mean, I think having gone through all of that, and also the truth of it is having some public life and some success in my life as a writer, I feel better now. Thank you. I used to feel literally so awful, and that my presence on earth was so tentative that I wouldn't buy like the 4-pack of toilet paper. The one roll was good enough. Because I wasn't going to need any more than that. No, it's true. I mean, it's in all seriousness, I wouldn't buy a big container of milk. I wouldn't even buy tickets to things ahead of time. And this is, I mean, that's like a pretty bleak existence. Like, I'd love to see that play, but I won't live long enough. So forget it. And so now I just feel like I'm allowed to exist, and that it's okay for me to be here. And that's it sounds dramatic, but it really was that dramatic. Mm. And it not like it happened overnight. It was a very hard one. I think it took till I was about probably 45. Which was maybe a week ago. And also, you know, the truth, and people always say, like, has being a parent changed your writing? And it hasn't changed my writing, it's changed my life, because I now have somebody that I need to show up for.
Right.
And she needs a lot of toilet paper, I hate to say that. I don't know what she's doing with it. It's always like she's decorating the house with it sometimes. And then the kids have these parties, they come over and they want to make mummies out of each other, and I'm like, there goes 4 rolls right there! You know? Gotta go back
it's
to
good
work.
For you. It's
I know,
good for
it's
you.
Very
go
good
and buy
for me,
toilet
but it's really,
paper.
I am like, you know, and I have, of course, because I'm overprepared, I have plenty of everything.
Well, you say at the end of the memoir that you'd thought about adopting a child yourself,
yes.
But it was actually your grandmother's death that made you feel the need for a biological child.
Yeah, I mean, I think any
and
child,
this whole,
really.
Any,
yeah,
but
yeah.
This whole experience must have brought that out in you.
I think... Yeah. I think it's one of those things that when most people grow up in their biological families, they're not that aware of it. And I think the thing about being adopted is a little bit as though, and I describe it it sounds pretty extreme, but it's like you're born as Abe Lincoln, and then they tell you later you're Teddy Roosevelt. And you're like, but I thought it was Abe Lincoln. Like, you know you're Abe Lincoln, you know that you live in a different world, but all of a sudden you're in this other family that is not just physically very different from you, but it's also... the hard wiring is different. And then all of a sudden, you know, as an adult, if you have a child, you actually see someone with your gestures and your habits. And my child has this similar personality. I mean, we get both very angry at each other, and we're like, ah! And we both look at it and go, ah! And then we start, like, laughing, because it's all so absurd in a way. It's nice. It's really nice. And the other piece of it that's so funny is that when I wanted to have a child, my mother was insulted. She's like, why would you want to have a child of your own? Is adoption not good enough? It's just like, well, you know. You know, it's a common desire. I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah. You said people ask you how having a child has changed your writing.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned earlier the sort of the more hopeful, positive ending of this novel. And also kids are kind of the calm center of this book. They provide the hope and the sanity. Is this a new phase for AM?
No, you know what's so funny about that is everyone always... Not everyone, I shouldn't say. Everyone always says that.
Sorry.
I know, I didn't mean that. Sounds horrible of me. It's so ungenerous. It's been said... Whatever. Okay, so from the first novel, Jack, which I wrote when I was 19, before I had children, Jack is a story of a 14-year-old boy, and it's also really about hope and finding the meaning of family. So I would say there is a consistency throughout the work that people often don't notice, that they really are all about family. And interestingly, I've often written about children, because I always think you see children in literature and films and theater even, and they're often props. They're like part of something, but they're not really given full value. And I've always been fascinated by how children think, and in a way, the limits and boundaries of their perspective that inform a story a lot. So I've got children and old people. I love animals. I'm very good-natured, actually.
She is.
I am, despite it all.
You teach creative writing.
Yeah.
How do you teach it? How do you teach someone to write?
I tickle them really hard, and then, no. I think it's a really hard thing to teach, and I think the interesting thing is, so I'm working with students, I'm at Princeton University, and I'm working with students who mostly are not people who are going to be writers. They may be scientists or engineers or computer programmers or doctors. And I really love that. I've worked a lot in other places where people have already, they're in master's programs and so on for writing. But the first thing I'm trying to teach them is to go back to using their imagination. And I think that we have forgotten sort of how to do that. And I think about the future. And the future for especially college students now is not going to be based on anything that we know right now. It's going to be based on what you can imagine, and that's technological, medical, all of it. So you have to really be able to conceptualize and get beyond the boundaries of what you know. So I do a lot of exercises. I have them writing in class and reading out loud, which is incredibly hard to do, but it gets everyone moving really quickly. We do a lot of drawing. I give out colored pencils, and we're drawing things. It's not like probably any other creative writing class.
If there are any aspiring authors in the audience, have you got a tip?
Just keep writing.
Yeah.
Write and write and write and read. I mean, that's the other funny thing is a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to read because they're like afraid of the influence of it. I think you have to take in a lot of material and enough stories. But the other piece of it is you have to just write constantly. And you can't, you know, people say, I can't write if I don't have a deadline. I go, then it's over. Because there's nobody anywhere who's going to be, excuse me, your story is due now. It just doesn't happen that way. You have to write because you can only write, you know, that you're compelled to write.
Yeah. Although you were telling me earlier that your writing is getting crowded out by your own volunteerism.
Yeah.
You may be surprised to find or to learn that A.M. Holmes is actually a Girl Scouts leader. Girl Scouts!
I am a Girl Scout leader. It's so funny. It's like, and I always think it's so funny because everyone's like, the transgressive writer, A.M. Holmes. I'm like, I'm a girl. I sell cookies. So, you know, I teach little kids how to make scrambled eggs. And the truth is the weirdest, and it sounds so antithetical. I love it. I take enormous pleasure in it.
What do you get from it? You're obviously giving a lot to other people. What's in it for you?
I feel like in all the things that I do, well, two things. One is I feel like the greatest teachers that I ever had, including today I saw Tom Keneally for a drink, who was a teacher of mine. The best teachers teach you not about the subject. They teach you about life and how to be a person. And one of my greatest sort of successes, I've had students who've published books and won prizes, was the student who became a rabbi. I thought, wow, I made a rabbi. That's incredible. Because it's like, you know, that's like, wow, that's big stuff.
Yeah. But you're involved with Yaddo, the writers.
Well, Yaddo is this 100-year-old artist colony, and I'm chairing their board. And part of it is that it is 100 years old, so it's falling down. Mm. And trying to figure out how to save and preserve this building, and also what writers and artists in the future need. And Yaddo is a place where Patricia Highsmith finished Strangers on a Train there, and she actually went because Truman Capote sent her there. He wanted her apartment for the summer. He's like, go to this place, Yaddo, get out of here. And you know, everyone, James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, Aaron Copland, Leonard Bernstein. And actually, a couple of years ago, I was there, and this incredible guy from Australia was there with this beard that was like down to here, and it's in the woods. And it's a beautiful Australian artist whose name I don't remember, incredibly long hair. And the funniest thing was, he's like, you know, I can't do the accent, but I've just arrived from Australia. And I said, oh, do you know my friend so-and-so? He's like, of course I do. And then he went for a walk, and he said, I see all these notes are out about ticks, because we have a bug called a tick that you get a disease called Lyme disease. Right. So he goes, how do I be careful of the ticks? And if they bury in your hair. And I was like, I don't know what to say to you. Because he was just like this huge, you know, I just thought, take the tweezers. I don't, you know, it's just, yeah.
But I'm going to ask for your questions in just a moment after I've asked my last question. But I was just going to say, you mentioned Tom Keneally, and I think actually we can claim you as an Australian writer. What did you learn? What did you learn from Tom Keneally? Do you remember the classes with him?
Yeah, I do remember. And I think the thing that's so interesting about him and so many of the writers who've meant a lot to me is the range of his work. And people always say to me, like, well, how do you write from a male point of view? How do you do this? I think, look at a writer like Tom Keneally. The subject matter that he's written about, the variety, it's incredible. And Peter Carey's work, there's just so many wonderful writers. So I think that you know, part of it is not having preconceptions and not saying, you know, women writers should write about this. They should mostly write about folding laundry. There's special techniques that only women know about how you fold the laundry. And apparently a male writer can't get to that. Freedom of exploration. Mm. And even just now when I was having the drink with Tom, and I don't know if this is out of school to say, he told the best story about having long ago gone to the Antarctic and actually taken a biscuit, appropriated a biscuit from the hut there. And in 1968, he went to bring the biscuit back, which I love that he still had the biscuit, and having to land on an iceberg. She just think, where do you get stories like that? You know,
Tom's a great gleaner
Absolutely.
Of stories.
Just love him.
And you recorded the ABC's program, First Tuesday Book Club.
Yeah.
Tell us about the book you chose. I was very interested in your choice and why.
Peter Carey's The Chemistry of Tears. Well, first off, the title is just, I mean, The Chemistry of Tears. I love that. People say to me, do you speak a foreign language? And I go, crying. That's the only other language I know. that weave of, again, it's a story that takes place partially in 2010, partially in 1854. It's a beautiful sort of a romance about grief and a meditation, too, on the difference between man and machine. It's about this father who goes in search of someone to build him this enormous mechanical duck, essentially for his dying son, and then the curator whose lover who works at the museum, whose married lover, has recently died, being the one who's charged with trying to put it back together. And I just love that cross-pollination of time and story.
Well, we'll have to wait a few weeks to hear more about it.
Yeah.
We have a question over here.
My request is, could you tell us all a little bit more about your love of art?
Oh, sure. That was a surprise. It could have been anything, right? So I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my father was a painter, and he also was a very politically active guy, and he believed you couldn't eat things that weren't picked by union workers, and you couldn't do things that weren't whatever. But somehow, if you went to a museum, you could get anything you wanted to eat in the cafeteria, and it was also the only place he would buy you anything, a book or whatever. So I spent my childhood basically in search of, like, Jell-O, chocolate cake, and books, which meant that I spent every weekend sitting in the museum looking at art, and I got this incredible inadvertent art education. And then I went to art school and actually studied painting and studied photography for a while. And I love it. I mean, I think in imagery. I don't think in words at all. And I guess for me as a writer, I, you know, sort of achieved a kind of early success that in a way alienated me for a lot of other young writers. And I found sort of another home in the art world where my success or whatever had nothing to do with the hierarchy of things. So as you mentioned earlier, I do every year a few collaborations with artists. And I started, for years I wrote traditional art criticism, and I liked doing that, but then I realized I could do this other thing where I would interview artists about how they make what they make and why they make it. And then I write fiction really for the artist and their work, and we do it together in a book with their work. And then they pay me in artwork, and that's nice. I like that
lovely.
A lot. Yes, it's a good
Fabulous.
Way. I'm so sorry that Picasso is dead now, because I would have loved it. Have I got a short story for him? No. And the truth is, I just love it. I mean, I don't know. I can't say enough about it. It means the world to me. And every city that I go to, the way I orient myself is I go to a museum. I mean, that's because that to me is like a sacred space. So as soon as I get to a place, and you can be all rattled or whatever, but you can't be anxious in a museum. Have you ever noticed that? You go in there and it's like, you know.
Mm. Do you still do much journalism? Are you still involved with Vanity Fair?
I do things for Vanity Fair. I do things for everybody. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, don't answer the phone. And it's funny. So Grace Paley is a teacher. I remember sitting in her apartment on 11th Street in New York, and the phone rang. She's like, oh, hi, so-and-so, blah, 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 talking. She says, sure, of course. I'll be there, not a problem, can't wait, look forward to it. She hangs up, and she goes, why did you let me say yes? I was like, I'm like 12. I'm like, I don't know. But it's like that. I do, you know, I do all kinds of things.
What do you what do you write about? What sort of subjects?
I just did I shouldn't say the weirdest, but I just got asked, W Magazine was doing a special issue with Sofia Coppola, and they said, will you write a short story for this special issue? And I thought, okay, you know, and I don't really know how to do that. And so I ended up writing a story about a woman named Natalie Rappaport, who was supposedly a famous children's book writer in France, whose parents had been, one of them had been a spy, and I forgot what, the other had been a paperclip heiress, which is a common thing. And Natalie Rappaport wrote the Mrs. Pomplemousse books about an elephant who married a guy who became an ambassador, and they had children, and they lived in France, and so on and so forth. So I wrote this incredibly ornate story, and of course now I get these things, people go, I've been Googling Natalie Rappaport all day, and I can't find anything. I'm like, I made her up. you know, so it's, yes, which was a fun, that was just fun. Incredibly good fun
for
me.
And you get paid.
And I got paid.
This will be our last question, probably.
Welcome to Sydney, Ian.
Thank you.
The book has got that real feel of a roller coaster, and reading it, you often, in the evening, I had to go back a few pages to pick up the pace again. I was wondering to what extent you had to do that as a writer. To what extent was it plotted, and to what extent did it just, I suppose, spill out of you?
Well, I think the funny thing is always, it took 7 years to write. And I remember just sitting there thinking, again, why is this taking so long? So it's very, very condensed. And my process is always, I write and I rewrite sort of simultaneously. So I write and then I print it out. And I also wrote a lot of this, not that this is interesting, but it by hand, because I feel like the connection, literally pencil to paper, is a very clear connection. So I write things down. Then I have horrible dyslexia. No one can read my handwriting. So I have to type it immediately. So I think I always was kind of going back, but it's not particularly plotted. I think sometimes I'll know a bigger idea that has to come next, but then I have to say, how am I going to get there? Or how do I write my way there? And there's digressions in it, like the whole Woodsman program. There's a moment where George, the mental hospital where he's sent, closes to become an executive conference facility, which happens a lot to mental hospitals. And he's sent off into a program called the Woodsman, where he's sent into the woods to live with other criminals, and there's just like government cheese and lockers that they can get to. It's a little bit like Survivor in some way. And then he meets up with an Israeli arms dealer who's also in the woods, and somehow with an iPad they open a whole store, basically. But I allowed myself like digressions like that, which for me were fun, and a couple of my friends said, oh, don't do that. And I thought, I'm just going there. I want to have fun. I'm desperate to have fun.
And the critics didn't seem to mind.
They didn't seem to mind.
The readers didn't mind.
Right, and I think, the funny thing too is, so this was, I think, it was probably like a 10th book for me, and I think there is that moment where, and Grace told me this longer, she said, the thing is, as a writer, you never advance. You never become like CEO of your company, or you're never the senior vice president in charge of marketing. Every time you finish a book, you just go back to being a writer. And every book, you're like, how does this one go? And you're just thrown back to the beginning. But you do develop some craft, and I guess in some ways a little bit of kind of confidence. You think, I can do this. And so this time I just thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to enjoy myself. And the fantastic thing is that this book has been enjoyed by so many other people, which I didn't know that we all had so much in common in that way.
Yeah. Do you think you can keep doing this?
No.
For... Okay, well.
No, it's terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
The next book was just not funny.
Yeah, right.
I remember for a while I wrote a bunch of short stories, and I remember thinking, God, these stories have no sex in them. And I thought, people are going to hate these stories. I certainly did. No. So I think it's a hard thing, but I hope I can do something, that's both entertaining and moving. I mean, you want it to be moving, because otherwise, I always say to the students, there has to be a reason why you're asking me or your reader to stop living their life and come and be in this book, or come and pay attention to this. And I think that you need to make sure that that's there, whatever that is.
And I think we learn about ourselves by reading your books, definitely, about parts of ourselves we maybe don't even look at a lot of the time. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And please thank her for a wonderful session.
Thank you for an incredible session. That
was writer A.M. Holmes in conversation with Susan Windham, the literary editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. It was recorded at this year's Sydney Writers Festival. Next week on Best of the Festivals, a wonderful lineup: crime writers Adrian McKinty and Val McDermott. So do join me from 6 each night next week. I'm Cassie McCullough. Have a great weekend.